Okay, everyone, if I can have your attention. Got a laid-back crowd out there. But it's time to get revved up. Yeah, welcome. I am going to call to order the first general session of the Spring 2000 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. To 2007. We're gonna make it 2005 though, because of the last night. We're gonna do that. Yeah, that was a good year, so we're gonna continue in that tradition. Okay. We are going to begin today with our invocation, and there's a slight switch from the agenda as written. Our invocation this afternoon will be presented by Rabbi Rorven Taff. He is from the Mosaic Law Congregation Conservative, and I now present to you for the invocation, Rabbi Taff.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed an honor to be here this afternoon with all of you. You know, I'm told that my role this afternoon is to invoke. Does anybody know what that word means? My understanding of that word is that an invocation is an appeal or a petition to a higher power, a prayer. An invocation, I am told, is a method of establishing conscious ties with those aspects of the Almighty who dwells within us. And so, ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon, as I invoke, allow me to share something about two people who inspire me and who I hope will inspire all of you. The first person is a man by the name of Eric Weihenmayer. Does anyone know who Eric Weihenmayer is? I see you do. As you all know, or most of you know, Eric is blind. And Eric just happened to successfully climb El Capitan, the 3,000-foot sheer rock face in Yosemite National Park. Here is what Eric said, and I quote, "Someone told me that blind people need to realize their limitations, but I think it's more exciting to realize my potential," end quote. You know who the other person that inspires me is? The other person who inspires me is a man by the name of Richard Conway Casey. Have you ever heard of Richard Conway Casey?
I believe I
have. I don't see people cheering. Some of you may know who he was. You see, he died just 3 weeks ago. May his memory be for a blessing. Richard Conway Casey of the United States District Court in Manhattan, New York, was our nation's first blind federal judge. And he spent almost an entire decade on the bench. And on the bench, he was blunt with both lawyers and witnesses alike. Do you know that he used to use humor? And he said, and I quote, "It doesn't start out funny being blind," he said. "You get mad, you get angry, you get depressed. But then you choose to either sit there and wait to die, or you get up and you move on. Once you make that decision, then you can find humor." And Judge Casey found humor in himself. Do you know that when his law clerk helped him into the courtroom, he walked the judge into a courtroom wall? And the judge snapped immediately and said to him, "You're fired. Bring back my guide dog." And laughter filled the entire courtroom. Judge Casey had to overcome skeptics when he took a load of 300 to 400 cases beginning in late 1997 using computer and audio technology while studying documents and preparing to speak in court. And do you know, folks, some people questioned whether a blind judge could accurately assess the credibility of a witness he could not see. Judge Casey said truth could be found by following the facts to see if they held together in a coherent, logical way. And he did occasionally swap a trademark case with a colleague because it depended on visual observation. So, ladies and gentlemen, today I hope you will think of the mountain climber, Eric, and I hope today you will also think of the judge who climbed mountains in a courtroom thousands of miles away in Lower Manhattan, both of whom are an inspiration to all who are blind, to all who are sight challenged. By the way, I don't like the term sight impaired. I like the term sight challenged. And I hope and pray that there'll be an inspiration to all to understand that there is always a silver lining. My prayer is that all of you who are gathered here today continue to carry the torch in reaching out to all who are blind and sight challenged, who live in our great state of California. I ask that you continue your efforts to lobby those who make our laws to ensure that all people in our state recognize that the citizens of our state who are blind and visually challenged all have the potential and the capability to lead active, productive lives and live harmoniously with all who are privileged to dwell in this great state of California. May all of you be blessed with strength, with courage, and continue to carry the torch. And let us all say, Amen.
Amen.
God bless you, and thank you for allowing me to be here with you.
Thank you, Rabbi Taft. That was outstanding. Many of us do know Mr. Casey, and that is a very tough loss. He's a pretty incredible guy. Okay. Gene Ackerman, are you in the room?
I'm sorry.
No, you're up here somewhere?
Yes, you're
right. Want to get her to
Everyone,
a mic?
Everyone, please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Hand over your heart, right hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Gene. Okay, to introduce our our first speaker of the day, give us a welcome. I would like to introduce one of my Capital Chapter members, and a very hardworking member indeed. I would like to introduce Warren Cushman.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Sacramento. Again. All right. Today I've been asked to introduce someone I've known for almost 10 years. Don and I have discussed and debated and most of the time agreed on policy here in Sacramento County. Don is a hard-working board member who really does struggle with a lot of weighty issues, some of which I still don't understand. So with no further ado, I'd like to introduce to you this afternoon the chair of the county, Sacramento County Board of Supervisors, Don Natoli.
Well, thank you, Warren, for those kind comments and for your willingness to introduce me today. Sometimes that can be risky when you have to introduce the elected official, but I would just say that Warren and many others in the community certainly have been good friends over the years. I've appreciated Warren's advocacy, his passion for a number of very important issues and resolution of those issues in our community. I want to also say welcome to Sacramento on behalf of the Sacramento County Board of Supervisors. And it's delightful to be able to have the privilege to join with you this afternoon to say some opening comments and again to welcome you. I want to thank your president for the California Council of Blind, Jeff Tom. I know I had a chance to just meet him here a few moments ago, but anytime you get to serve in a leadership position, there's a good deal of responsibility that goes with that. And I think also the dedication of time. Most times you're a willing participant in the process that gets you to that office, but sometimes you also find out that the work and the effort you've taken on can be one that's pretty weighty. But I want to thank again all of you as attendees of the Spring Convention, but also certainly your president, your officers, and all the folks that are part of today's and this weekend's program. I want to just take a couple of moments to say to you, and many of you certainly, this isn't your first visit to Sacramento. You may very well reside here, but it's really, I think, this time of the year is an opportunity certainly to come together for a convention, for the serious business that you're about throughout the program that you have, but also a chance to come together to socialize, to share, share those things that are going on in your lives, and hopefully the many, many things that inspire each of you in your daily lives to do the work that you do, to participate in this organization, but also the contributions you make to this community and to your respective communities that you come from here today to this convention. And Sacramento, we're very blessed, as we are in California, to have weather that's pretty predictable, although this weekend you're going to get sunshine today. I'm not a weatherman. If I did my job sometimes the way weather people predict theirs, I would really be in trouble. But they do the best they can, but we're expecting rain tomorrow and then again sunshine on Sunday. But I know that won't dampen the spirits here in the convention center here at the Hilton, nor will it, I think, obstruct your work. But I want to also encourage you, as part of your working effort here, is to take time out, certainly to share with one another, but hopefully get a chance to experience some of the things about Sacramento that do make it, not only from the standpoint of its climate, but make it a very friendly and welcoming community. And I know that the Kings are going to be in town this weekend, and even though we're wrapping up the NBA season, and tickets are sometimes hard to come by, maybe this end of the season there might be some tickets there. Also, we have museums and many wonderful eateries. If Mayor Fargo were here, she would tell you that there's been many, many dozens of new restaurants that have opened in the downtown recently. So if you're able and interested in to get out and about the evenings, certainly in the daytime in between the sessions, we'll have a very, I think, a wide array of opportunities for you to participate in. But I know you have some very serious work here and certainly want to compliment you for your leadership as a part of the California Council of the Blind, your various chapters, and certainly the other organizations that you represent here today. And I want to just note, too, that here in Sacramento County, that for those of you that don't know, we're about 1,400,000 people in the county of Sacramento now. We have a very, diverse, I know, it's been noted as being one of the most diverse communities. And when you have diversity, it certainly offers the opportunity to learn from one another, and I think to hopefully to build a community that is accessible to all, that's inclusive, and certainly that has the opportunities and access that each of us should expect as citizens of this great country and certainly of this great state and of the communities that constitute it. So I want to welcome you on behalf of my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors and to just say to you that as I heard Rabbi Taft talk about an inspiration and some people that have been inspirational, that each of you in your own right, whether you recognize this or not, is an inspiration to those around you. And for those of us who may not have the sight challenges that many in this room do, we may take for granted something that's very, very precious. And yet you folks make such significant contributions in so many ways and, again, serve as an inspiration and I think as a conscience to those of us who work in public life but also as a broader community. And so it's a delight to be able to be here today. I want to also, before I step away here, thank Gene Lozano for the invitation to be able to be with you today and thank, again, Warren for his very kind introduction. And just note on kind of a humorous note that one of the things that I learned long ago, and this is my 13th year as supervisor, and it's a privilege to serve as a member of the elected body of this county, but our chairmanship rotates. But I learned long ago that, and it wasn't something that I coined the phrase of, and some of you may have heard it, but I believe President Truman was the one that really coined it, that he said about people who offer comments that you need to be brief, be sincere, and then be seated. And so I'm about to be seated here in just a moment. So, that's a first applause. There you go. President Truman was right. So, but I do want to, one more time, again, extend a big hearty congratulations to you on your work. I commend you to your work. You've got a full agenda, a full session, several full sessions. And before I step away, though, is that with President Tom, just to stand for a moment, I have a lapel pin that has the seal of the great county of Sacramento, and I want to present that to you, Jeff, and I'll place it there. And that's a token of our welcome to you, and certainly to all of you, we say welcome. Have a great stay. Thank you. Have a great conference. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Antoli. That is great. That is, I'm now an official resident, I guess.
We won't charge you taxes, though. You're okay.
Yeah. I think I'm paid up. Okay. I want to mention that we are around the state, around the country, around the world on ACB Radio. Let's hear it for ACB Radio. I want to thank Chris Gray for really spearheading the efforts in this regard and making sure that this got done. I want to give a special thank you to our audio folks, our veteran Rick Acacia, who will be hearing from maybe tomorrow. This is going to be his last convention. We'll really miss him. And his new sidekick, who's going to be taking over and who's just really great as well, Teresa Santiago. Let's hear it for both of them. And finally, one of my very favorite people, Miss ACB Radio, Marlena Lieberg. Okay, I'm going to introduce to you our next, our first panel, actually, of this convention. And I want to thank Gene Lozano, who will be with us tomorrow. He's back in New York talking about transit cars and how to fill the gap so that people don't get severely injured, as we've found in some instances that we all know about. So he's off doing that, and he will be back tomorrow. So he set up this panel. This panel is called Where We Are and Where We Need to Be in the Implementation of AB 422. And I'm just going to introduce the panelists, and I'll let them talk about the topic. First, we have Mary Chang, Director of Accessible Technology Initiative, California State University, East Bay. Michael Bastine, Director, Alternate Text Production Center, California Community College Chancellor's Office. And Brad Neely, Disability Service Coordinator, University of California at Merced. So, panelists, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you, Jeff. Good afternoon. What a spirited conference. What spirited people you are. I come here and I'm a little bit tired because I've been on the road, but I am energized. So thank you so much. I am Mary Ching, and I am actually from the California State University system, the Chancellor's Office, working on a system-wide project called the Accessible Technology Initiative. It is a project that spans the 23 campuses of the California State University system, trying to create a culture of access for an inclusive learning environment at the CSU. And so one of the challenges that we have is how do we create and obtain accessible instructional materials for students with disabilities. So we're, I've been working on this very issue for about 7 years in various capacities. I started as director of disability services at the East Bay campus at Hayward. And there I had the firsthand experience of seeing the role of technology, the role of technology for creating independence, for creating access for students with print disabilities. And what I've seen is that students who are able to get their hands on digital texts, or what we call e-texts, and they're able to use the technology to hear and listen and search, you know, the text, that they are so much better at getting that information and doing well in school. We have transitioned in the last 2 or 3 years. We have transitioned from books on tapes, which are very, very valuable, to what we call e-text or electronic text. And the e-text is powerful because you can search, you can locate things, you can find the vocabulary, you can check the spelling, you can do the dictionary on new words that you know that you don't know. So e-text is very important. And California is the first state that passed an e-text law for higher education. This is called AB 422. And in 1999, it was when this law was chaptered. At the first few years when this law was passed, there were a lot of frustration from the community, from students, from disability services professionals, about the fact that the law is not working. Because when we try to go to the publishers, the law says, let me back up, the law says that the publishers are required to give a free e-text to a student with a print disability who have gone through the campus, you know, and gotten verification, and who has purchased a book, that student can then get a free copy of the e-text, the electronic text of the textbook. So when we who are in disability services requested from the publishers, you know, give us the e-text, they look at us as though, you know, we were talking from Mars or Venus or wherever, okay? They didn't know what we were talking about. And so it took a few years after the law was passed in order for the publishers to, and for the disability services community to come up to speed about, you know, how do we actually get these e-texts to the students who need them. So let me talk to you about, share with you a couple of initiatives that have occurred over the past 2 or 3 years. The first one is the AHEAD E-Text Institute. AHEAD is actually the national organization for disability professionals and higher education. So these are your disability service directors and their staff. And the AHEAD E-Text Initiative was working with the publishers to come up with solutions. How do we get this done? And I'm happy to say that the publishers are, through the American Association of Publishers, have brought together an initiative called the Alternate Format Solutions Initiative. This was launched in 2006, and it was a collaborative effort to develop a practical set of effective solutions to the real challenges of getting textbooks into alternate formats on a timely basis for post-secondary students with disabilities. So imagine if you were a student in one of our college campuses. You don't, because it takes so long to create the alternate format of the textbook, you don't get the textbook until midway into the semester or into the quarter. Now, is that equal access? No, it isn't. And so we're working very hard, and the publishers are recognizing this. We're working very hard to see what can we do to create a situation where students with disabilities will have access to the textbooks at the same time as any other student. This is a very difficult challenge, but we're making some headways. At the California State University system of 23 campuses, we're asking our faculty to help out. We're asking faculty to identify their textbooks early so that we get to know what the title is, so we can either request it from the publisher or get it converted. Secondly, we're asking our faculty, when they order their books from the publishers, to ask the publishers to make sure that there's going to be an accessible version for anybody who needs it. And thirdly, we're asking the faculty to say, we're sharing the accessible textbooks with our faculty and saying that these are all of the textbooks that have been converted. You know, if you are teaching a math course and there's already a calculus class, course or textbook that has been brailled, then use that one. Adopt that textbook. And so we're getting a lot of support from our faculty across the 23 campuses, and we're very excited about that. So these are just a few of our efforts. We have in the California State University system, we also have the Center for Accessible Media, where we're asking our campuses to share resources with one another so that if I have a Braille book or a book that is an e-text and another campus needs it for another student, that we have a way through this database to share that information so we don't have to spend time and resource in converting it again. So our motto is create the book once, and so that we can get it into the hands of the students in a timely manner. So I'm going to now turn over to my colleagues, two of my colleagues. One is from the community college, Mr. Michael Bastine, who will talk about the Alternate Text Production Center and what is happening at the community colleges. And also after him will be Brad Neely from the University of California, who will be talking about it from that perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Hello, folks. I'm happy to be here today in Sacramento. And being able to speak with all you folks about the center, which the Alternate Text Production Center, which I direct in Ventura, California. It possibly may be a resource for you and your loved ones to utilize. We are a center that was created because of AB 422. We are a center funded by the California Community Colleges, and primarily to support the California Community Colleges, but we've recently been allowed, permitted, to provide Braille documents for learning institutions outside of the California Community College system. Right now, California has 109 community colleges, and there's a whole lot more schools out there than just the community colleges. As we know, there's the UC family of schools and the CSU family of schools, and there's the rest of the country and private schools. So recently, we've been allowed to provide Braille to schools outside of the California Community College. And this could be, now we have calls from all over the country and even international to provide Braille textbooks, learning materials. The way the system works is we have a budget to provide digital texts and Braille texts to California schools, California Community College students at no charge. Our budget is to pay for those textbooks to make sure the playing field is level. Schools outside of the California Community College system would go through their learning institution and request Braille, and then it's basically a cost that we pass on. The cost to do the Braille, the production itself. And if we have time, I'm going to be staying around here for the rest of the afternoon. I'd love to meet with anyone here and answer your questions as far as maybe what we could do for you to provide learning materials or for someone that you know that's going to school. We're relatively new. 2002 was the birth of our center. And since then, we have over 7,000 documents in our catalog. Approximately 400 are Braille. The others are digital format. But we have staff, literally international staff, to do transcription, tactile graphics. We can do Nemeth. We can do music Braille, foreign language. We do the top quality, the highest, the most complex Braille that the students need in whatever field or discipline they're going into. I have a stellar workforce that is devoted and passionate about this mission that we have. My coordinator for the digital text, electronic files, came from, of all places, Hanna-Barbera. He was a computer whiz, an illustrator, animation, graphic artist for over 35 years, and now he's in charge of our digital electronics and making sure that we have the electronics for our students. And then our Braille coordinator is an individual who came from an art background. She has a computer graphics background, and she's worked in the government system for years. And she has comprised an army of transcribers and tactile graphic artists, proofers, of nearly 100 individuals. And she's my band leader or orchestra conductor, who has 40 projects, 40 programs, 40 books going on all at the same time, and all these people all over the world are creating bits and pieces of these textbooks, and then they all come together and we compile it and proof it and then get it out to the college. So it's an awesome task, but one that we enjoy doing. One aspect of our center is that we're the go-between from the students out at the college and the publisher. A college realizes they need a textbook for a student. They validate, make sure the student truly needs the textbook, it's the right textbook for the class, and then they validate what type of textbook end product they want. Do they want digital? Do they want MP3? Do they want to listen to their history lessons on the iPod? Do they want Braille? What medium do they want it in? And then they come to us, and they ask us to get the electronic file. And we turn around and we go to the publisher, and we in turn ask for the files that have been requested from us. And let me tell you, we've dealt with over 400 publishers, and each one has their own personality. Since 2002, we've created a rapport with many of them just by the simple sheer quantity of books that we've ordered over the years. But to be honest, some publishers were on a first name basis with. We do the permission slips. We pass all the documentation for copyright because that's a sensitivity that publishers have. And then there's some publishers that won't even return our phone call. So we can waive the AB 422 legislation and the Ed Code that gives us our walking papers, but. Some of the places we deal with are on the East Coast, and depending on who we talk to, determines how they respond to our legislation. But things are getting better each year. There's more of awareness. And now the lights come on. We're only one center that requests from a publisher a certain textbook. They get calls from all other colleges too, saying we need math book XYZ, and then Podunk University, we need math book XYZ, and then we, the center, hey, we need math XYZ, and they're saying, well, instead of addressing each request from all over the country, maybe there would be some goodness of having a clearinghouse or a centralized place, a database, where we could, instead of having all these individual colleges and scenarios calling each publisher individually. So, as Mary alluded to, there's some initiatives going on that would benefit us at the user end and benefit the publishers at their end, too. So, fortunately, just this last year, we've worked at increasing our budget at the center, and we're able now to go on the road and go to these national forums and wave the flag and say, you know, this is who we are, this is what we do, this is why we need your support, publishers, and it's helped in a lot of crosstalk. Let me give you one example, and then I'll pass the mic on. Talking with publishers, a valid question is, why do you call on Monday and ask for a book on Tuesday? You know, we've got thousands of books, and we publish, and we cannot respond that way. And we tell them, well, there's a lot of different reasons, but sometimes the second week in the semester, a student registers. They didn't know or realize they had to take the course. So they registered late, and now we get a request for the book late. Sometimes it's the faculty member. The faculty member doesn't submit the books that they're going to use for a given course, or they don't submit the syllabus. And so we don't know, no one knows what book is going to be used. Now, primarily, this is the post-secondary environment I'm talking about, where each individual faculty member can choose what textbooks they want to use in their course. So this gave the publishers an awareness, like, oh, okay, I didn't realize you were dealing with those things, with those types of issues. And then we go to the publisher saying, well, why don't you give us a book? You know, we tell you that we need it. We have a validated, we have a student with a validated print disability. They're enrolled in school. They've paid for the book. And we filled out the permission slips. Why don't you give us the book? Well, we don't hold the copyright. It's held by maybe a family of people, an illustrator, an author, or several illustrators, several authors. We don't have the authority to release it. Or the book is old, and we don't have the file that it was it was created in a manner that doesn't have an electronic file. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I guess we didn't realize that. So this is the kind of dialogue that's taking place now, and now we're working together trying to find a national solution, ideally, to make sure that all of us out there that want to go to school, want to get an education, want to continue our learning, can have accessible text in a timely fashion in the medium that you want it. And that's our whole purpose in life at the center, Alternate Text Production Center. And if anyone ever gets close to the Ventura College campus, I'd love to have you come in and show off our production facility. The door is always open, 8 to 5, and we'd love to have you there and show you what we do. And whatever it takes, call me. I've got cards. We can arrange tours, whatever it is. And again, thank you very much for having me here.
Okay. Before we open it for a couple questions, is Barbara Steffen in the room?
One more person.
Oh, we do. I'm sorry.
Brad
Neely, yes.
Well, good afternoon. Again, my name is Brad Neely. I am the UC Merced Disability Services Coordinator. UC Merced actually is the latest and newest campus in the UC system. We're the 10th campus. And I'm very excited to be there. I actually was a UCSC Santa Cruz student in the 80s, went through the system, and graduated in 1988 with a creative writing degree. Now, I realized I couldn't make money selling poetry on the streets of Santa Cruz, so I realized I should get a bread and butter job, and I ended up working for the university as a computer operator. And this is in the mid-80s. Now, at that time, the internet really wasn't the internet. It was simply a medium used for email and Usenet. But I realized that instruction, it was the medium of the future. And I knew that sooner or later, it was where our medium of instruction was going to be. So I've been keenly interested in watching how access to this medium is developing. And I think it's important to understand AB 422, access to alternative media, in the context of the bigger question of access to technology. And making it an accessible technology. It's not just software, it's not just hardware. It's this medium now we call the internet. And how does instruction play a part in that now, especially in the university settings, where we're seeing more and more of our information being delivered through the internet and through different mechanisms of alternative media. I know we're here to talk about AB 422, and I'm going to give you a kind of personal journey from my perspective. As I mentioned, I'm the Disability Services Coordinator, but I just took this position in January. I'm 4 months into it. Now, before you say, what happened here? I was in IT. I was a computer technician for 10 years, but my other life, which I'm actually very proud of, was as a disability community organizer in Santa Cruz. And that was a place that I really learned the range of the community and the range of disabilities in question in terms of the foundation of what we're really after, which is access, which is more than just about physical access, of course, because it's more about just how you get in through the door nowadays. It's how you're accessing information on an equal and equitable basis as others. So I'm very keenly aware of the civil rights aspects of this. This is, after all, the way that everyone is beginning to learn equally in the educational system is through accessible technology. So how are we going to do it? As the opportunity came for me to become the Disability Services Coordinator, let me tell you my first day on the job. We were serving 5 students with disabilities the semester before I came on board. This semester, I'm now serving 14 students with various disabilities. That's almost a 300% increase. So we're having folks coming in to the system here, and the needs for accessible media, alternative media, are likewise increasing dramatically. Now, it's not just for visual impairments here. It's also for learning disabilities. In fact, the majority of people that I am providing accessible alternative media for are those with learning disabilities. It's interesting. But we do have more people coming in with visual impairments that I'm serving. Now, back in the day as an advocate, you know, I was out on the streets going, access now, access now. And now I'm on the other side going, how am I going to deliver? It's a service delivery question now. It's the first day I have a student who I'm serving who needs alternative media, and needs her textbook transformed, as it were, into an audio file. She brings me her textbook. I'm said, well, how are you doing this? And I'm told by the previous person who was dealing with this, well, you take it, you cut it up, page by page, you feed it through a scanner, you do OCR on it, then you have to go through that text file and correct it, because you know how OCR works so wonderfully. Correct it until it's good enough to be read as a text file. You copy that into a Word document. Then we run another program that will turn that Word document into an MP3 file. Oh, but did I tell you that I can only do 6 pages at a time? Okay, I got to keep track of all the tracks for the MP3 so I can... And I'm going, wait a minute, of course, remember, and I'm from the IT world of things, I'm going, why are we taking a printed book and turning it back into data when it was already data at some point? So, hey, what's going on here? Well, we just couldn't find the publishers, just didn't have it. So wait, I said, no, let's do a little more digging here. But as I discovered, it's true. I mean, Mary and Mike have already pointed to this. In the publishing world, you know, I got on the phone. Hey, I need this textbook in alternative format, and I need it yesterday. I mean, classes are starting tomorrow. Okay, we're talking about equal access here. Well, let's see. You'll have to go to this website, go ahead and submit the form, and we can email it back to you. That was a great publisher. He had a system online. Loved it. 2 days turnaround time. I had a Word file that I could use, and boom. Another textbook, same process, same issue. Call up the publisher with that. Well, go to this website, download this file, fill out the form, email it, fax it back to us, and we'll see if we can get it to you in 4 to 6 weeks. So wait a minute, 4 to 6 weeks is going to be half the semester is going to be gone. That ain't going to work. But that's their system. Another publisher. We're locating them on the web. We can't find a place to call anybody to inquire about alternative media. So, well, let's go to the copyright permissions folks. Long story short, they have no alternative media. It's not available. Sorry, but I'll tell you what. I'll send you the book. And that's what they did. So I can cut it up, pay it, and everything else that I told you about. I'm just giving you a quick purview of what my world is like sometimes. Okay. But given that, I mean, let's go from, you know, you have to understand something about the UC system. You know, a lot of folks will think about a bureaucracy organization as kind of this monolithic creature. And everybody's, you know, pretty much on the same page. That's not the UC system, and I can't speak to the other systems, of course, but I'm pretty sure it's probably similar. Each campus really is autonomous. So when AB 422 was implemented or passed, it was left to each campus disability services office to figure out how to do it. And there's all kinds of funding issues associated with that and support, but I don't need to go into that. But in any event, the campuses themselves took on the job of figuring out how to provide alternative media. Eventually, though, what happens is that one disability service office starts talking to another one and says, you know, I'm having this issue. You know, I can't find this. So I said, well, you know, I know of a resource. And they start talking. And before you know it, we get a group of disability service offices start saying, you know, we should share resources. Great idea. Why reinvent the wheel? So in any event, what occurs is finally policy, it actually comes up from the ground floor, as it were, and goes up to the system-wide. And at that level, you have also issues of continuity, because people come and people go. But finally, at the UC system-wide level of things, a man named Clint Hayden came on board. And he is the UCOP Director of Campus Life, and he is leading this effort to look at this issue from a system-wide perspective and look at this issue in terms of how we can leverage resources not only amongst the system itself, how we can also learn from other systems. So this is Mary's effort in the technology initiative and Mike's effort in creating a center. We're realizing that we've looking at common issues in terms of the lack of a standardized method of delivery, the lack of a choice, in formats. You have to remember some file formats work for different purposes. Text file would be great for certain things. PDF can work for other things. Word. And I'm very much into favor of having a choice at least from my perspective, of what kind of file format I want to use for a certain student, because not all disabilities are the same in terms of what you do for that particular person. It's a case-by-case process. And that needs to be incorporated into any kind of delivery system that you develop. So, right now, we have convened a working group made up of many of the disability services offices in the UC system, where we are now looking at long-term and short-term goals. Our short-term goal, which we are moving toward rather quickly, is to have a communication system of all the disability services offices system-wide to say, what do you have available at your campus? And if you have this, I have a request for this, and then be able to send it over to them. That's our short-term goal that we're going to be moving toward rather quickly to implement. But the long-term goal for UC system-wide is questions about, well, an AT center. There's also discussion of looking at publishers and how to communicate our needs to them. I mean, when I first came on board, I said to myself, I said, wait, I mean, we're the UC system. We buy a lot of books. Why aren't we taking that economic leverage and saying to publishers, hey, you need to provide, when you sell us books, you already need to have it ready to go. And that's when I learned, as Mike has already described, that it's not done that way. We don't buy volumes of books, and it's really driven by faculty and what they choose to utilize as a textbook by their course. So you have another area that has to be negotiated with in terms of buy-in to, you know, we need to have a standardized mechanism. We need to have you, when you order a book, to also be requesting alternative media. And that is going to get the message to publishers that, you know, this is something to take a look at. And as Mary's already said, they're looking at an initiative to look at standardization of delivery formats. Now, what does that mean to you folks? Well, this is what I think. And this is my opinion. But I think you need to be involved. I think you need to be at the table when these entities get together and decide what is best for creating an alternative format delivery system, because consumer choice and voice needs to be part of that process. So I would encourage you as an advocacy group to look for opportunities to get involved in that discussion. Now, similarly, I know that one of our desires is to also work on a collaborative process and discuss these kinds of issues with consumers, students coming in, other community college systems, the California State University system, because we certainly can learn from them. And I've begun some of that dialogue, and others in the UC system and our working group have begun to look at exactly that. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. But, as I've said, there's a real need in my mind for the consumer advocates to get involved and be heard. And with that, I appeal to you to take that as a consideration of your next stage in advocacy efforts. Thank you.
Let's see. Okay. I'm going to ask one more time, just in case. Is Barbara, Stefan, are you in the room? Okay. We have time for, I think, two questions. Okay. We have time for two questions. And so if you want to ask a question, get forward and we'll get you to a mic.
Okay. Yes. With AB 422, did that include private usage? In other words, I know it's mainly for students, et cetera, but do you have a library outlet scenario where we can privately rent or privately pay for textbook information?
Okay. There are a couple of places. I don't know if you know bookshare.org. Akin to RFBND, where you can get a membership and you can download the e-text for anyone who is eligible to use that. So, yes, there are entities like that. But AB 422 only covers textbooks that are pretty much required for the course.
Okay. As a student that is currently in a community college getting ready to go to this, the four-year college, I haven't made my choice as to where I'm going, but I want to know if there is a committee that is made up of students that can, you know, go with to the meetings or you know, interact, because I noticed as a student myself that there isn't enough communication between the students and the staff, because we're not getting heard as much as we would like. And I mean, it's just, it's an equal access issue, and we need to be able to have a place to voice our opinion.
Hi, Brad Neely again. And well, I can tell you from my perspective and my experience at UC Merced what we're doing. And as I've mentioned, I kind of intimated, but you know, the independent living philosophy, and that certainly entails the idea of consumer involvement, empowerment, and choice, is very much a guiding force, at least in the way I deliver services. And as I tell my students, you know, we're a team in terms of deciding what's going to work for you or not. And that involves the active participation of my students in that discussion in terms of deciding what kind of service they need or don't need. Beyond that, though, one of the things that I'm very proud of being able to facilitate and working on currently is that we've started our first UC Merced Disability Student Association, which again is another forum and another place for students with disabilities to come together, discuss and discover common issues about access, about the social experience of discrimination, because that's what it really bonds between disabilities. Sometimes it's not just, it's not the disability, honestly. It's the social discrimination we all experience because of it. And that is something that I'm really looking forward to, because not only for the students themselves to become socially together and join and form a network for themselves, but also I think it's invaluable for me as a service delivery person to have that kind of input back. I mean, I need that to improve service. So if you want, come on to UC Merced. I'd be glad to help you.
Dan Kaiser, I'm the legislative advocate for the California Council of the Blind, and work very closely and with Daryl Steinberg to, you know, and the stakeholders to pass AB 422. And I have to say, I'm still pretty disappointed. I've heard some good things about from all of you today, and I'm not denigrating what you're doing, because you are actually working very hard, and you are the ones that are spearheading the process. And to the students, obviously, it's not all happening fast enough, but that's true for all access. It never happens fast enough. My question is, how are you addressing the professors that publish their own materials, and that are not willing to participate in your program, because this seems to be a fairly large problem?
I think it is. One of the things that we're trying to do at the California State University is to get our faculty engaged in learning how to create accessible materials, or provide the support for them to create accessible materials. Particularly right now, when so many things are online, faculty create their own materials and put them online. And we're trying to create workflows and give them tools and to give them support to help them create things accessibly from the get-go. So if they're doing a document with images, they put the alt tags in. If they're doing other things that they know how to do this accessibly from the get-go. But we're all going to have some faculty who are not going to do what we need them to do, no matter what. But hopefully those are a very small percentage, and then we can deal with them.
Penny Frazier, two-parter real quick. How can we get in touch with you? I'm not a student, but I'm very interested in this. How can we get in touch with you? And also, do you have... for those who don't have computers, do you also have audio listings in your database from audio all the way up through computers? for your how to get your textbooks.
The audio. Do you have audio in your holdings?
No. At the center, at the Alternate Text Production Center, we do not have audio files per se as an end user, but we do have digital files that can be converted into audio files at our catalog. So that's always an option. One comment I want to make to the lady who is a student at a community college and then going to a four-year school, each school has a student government, and that's the vehicle. Now, some are active and some aren't, but if you go into the student government and fire them up, because they have direct access to faculty and administration, they have a student rep that sits on the board of the faculty and of the administrative staff from the student government, and that's one conduit to light a fire under. Well, I would call the newspaper up. You know, public's a great thing. Yeah, yeah. Turn up the heat.
My name is Haley Edick, and I've been a student. I'm going to graduate now, but I'm at Cal State Long Beach. And I remember when this bill passed, and we as students were very, very excited. However, from my tech lab, I still get word that the publishers sent a very, very bad file of the text. Are they still doing that? And if so, why don't they just send us the regular text? Why does it need to be so have so many errors?
What kind of file were you describing?
My tech lab has said that when they contact publishers and when they actually release the e-text, I believe it's not in the format they want. I don't know what kind of format they're getting, but they have to do so much work to translate it into accessible formats that it's not really worth it. They have they usually take the books, cut off the spine, therefore you cannot sell them back to the bookstore. Therefore, you must keep all your textbooks around and nobody wants them. scan them in with one of those page feeders that mass scans.
Right. Well, our personal experience is it sounds like an individual or a particular publisher in your situation, because certain publishers are very accommodating and will provide it in any file, electronic file format you want, and some do not, which sounds like is your situation, or a very cumbersome file. I don't know if we are a resource that you can use if you go through your college or the local. I guess does your school have the capability in house to scan and to OCR? Okay.
They do that in-house, yes.
Yeah. Okay. But, go ahead.
The one thing that I learned, before I used to kind of get really frustrated at the publishers, is why don't they just give us that darn file and give it to us in a way that we can use it? But in the publishing world, there are big publishers and there are small publishers. Mm-hmm. The big publishers are, you know, they've getting their act together and they're probably better. But the small publishers, you have like sometimes mom and pop operations, and there's a learning curve there too, and for them it's a lot harder, you know, to get the files out. So I don't know if that is the case or not, but there is a variation in the publishers as well. And so hopefully through this initiative of the American Publisher Association that we will see some improvements.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Hi, Dirk Nyher, Berkeley chapter. My question is, can I get these books not as a student? I missed astrophysics and Zymergy when I was going to school 40 years ago, and I'd like to catch up.
I think that is a very, very important issue. And one that I try to raise with the publishers, that the solution that they bring together, or whatever solution we have for the national solution, that it needs to incorporate the lifelong learning of people. It's not just when you're in school that you want books. It's throughout your lifetime. And so I hope that that's one thing that you as an advocacy group can have some impact, that we need a solution that, you know, spans the lifetime of a person. So it's lifelong learning, and that individuals who are not connected with the school can still use, can still ask the publishers or use this whatever solution that we have. So, but I think that's a really critical issue that I've heard time and time again.
Yeah, but right now we have to go through a learning institution. That's what we have to go by.
Yeah. Yes.
Got to go to Stanford for one.
Rivalry.
It's up high. It's on a boom.
Okay. All right. This was obviously a great panel, as you can see by the level of interest. Let's hear it for all of our panelists. As I almost knocked the water over. Okay. Outstanding. And I want to say to the student very quickly as well that the one who's not getting her needs met, just call us at CCB. That's what we're here for. If we can't help you, then we're not doing our job. So get a hold of us. Okay. Next speaker, this is a topic that is certainly one that has raised a lot of interest over the last few years. I know it's something Jane Cardis is going to be familiar with. Using other media than computers to get your voicemail, to get your email and other things, searching the internet. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce the Chief Executive Officer of Internet Speech in San Jose, Imdad Khan.
Thank you, Jeff. First of all, I would like to thank California Council of the Blind and Jeff Thom and his team for inviting Internet Speech and myself to speak here. This is a great honor to be in front of you, especially many of our users also are here in this room. As you have heard, we are talking about going to the Internet using different mechanisms than computers. Basically, use a telephone to get to the Internet so that you can surf, search, email, even listen to streaming audio and shopping. Now, before I start, some short background, which you are probably familiar, but it's always a good idea to review. By the way, I have a thick accent, so I will try to be a little slow so that you can follow. You know, we are in the information age, and in this information age, information is money like time is money. So the largest source of information is the Internet, as you all know. And our premise is that everyone in this world should have the benefit to enjoy this Internet. Now, unfortunately, not everyone in this world today have the Internet, because the way to get to the Internet, there are only two broad ways. One is a computer. The other one is personal device like cell phone or PDA. Now, the computers are great, but not many people have one. And also those who have computers, it's not easy for them to learn. There are many people who need to spend a lot of time and effort to learn how to use it. And those who already know have difficulty in keep up with all the changes, keep on learning new things, adware, spyware, this and that. The personal devices are great devices, but their user interface for internet access is very, very difficult because of the small screen and small keypad. More importantly, to get some contents on a cell phone, those contents needs to be rewritten with another language like WML or CHTML. You know, there are over 2 billion of websites on the Internet, and to rewrite all of them with another language is not practical. So, to overcome these problems, Internet Speech has come up with a solution, which is go to the Internet using any telephone, cell phone or home phone or any phone, and you just talk and listen. So you don't have to worry about a small screen. You don't have to worry about content because you can get any content from the internet. You know, the internet was designed with visual access in mind. So all the information was laid out to attract our eyes, but not our ears. What we do from internet speech in our Netoko product is bank on the content on today's internet where billions of dollars have already gone into, take that information and in real time convert that or render that so that one can listen to it using any telephone in a manner that the content is short, precise, easily navigable, and pleasant to listen to. If we can achieve all those criteria, then we have a good story. And I'm going to show that right now in a demo so that you can see or understand how telephone-based internet works. Before that, just a brief background about internet speech. We are over 7 years old, Silicon Valley, San Jose-based company, and the service has been going on over 3.5 years. And there are many users, including users from CCB, who have been using this service. So after you make a phone call, then you are going to hear the following.
Welcome to NetEcho, powered by Internet Speech. Please save or key in your 10-digit account number.
408-360-0001.
Please say or key in your 4-digit PIN number.
1234.
Main menu. Please select from one of the following by saying that one or the category name. Search the net. Web search. Stock quote. My email. Today's news. More options. My Yahoo.
In the real system, you don't have to wait. You can just say whatever you'd like to say immediately.
My AOL. Help me, please. Or press 9.
Page highlights.
Page highlights will let you hear only the important information of the page, saving time.
Main menu. Please select.
Surf the net.
To go to our popular website, say popular websites. To go to bookmarked websites, say bookmarked websites. To use interactive spelling, say interactive spelling.
Popular websites.
Please say your popular website. For a list of popular websites, please say list popular websites.
Speech works.
Thank you. I'm going to speechworks.com. The highlights of this page are, first highlight, SpeechWorks congratulates winners of third annual best practices competition. Second highlight, Amtrak and SpeechWorks complete.
So instead of reading everything on the page, she's reading only the important information.
Third highlight, SpeechWorks deployed nation's first speech-enabled instant loan application.
First one.
So she's going to the first choice, and on this page, new page, she will read only the relevant story, saving a lot of time.
SpeechWorks news release. SpeechWorks congratulates winners of third annual best practices competition. Panel of industry experts selects Amtrak, National Weather Service, and Singapore Post for best applications and increased automation. Poker at Home, Florida. Conversations 2002, October 7, 2002, at its annual international user.
And now you can, you know, easily repeat the paragraph or jump to the next paragraph or previous paragraph and so forth. And you can also do other things like email and so forth. I'm going to talk about, you know, if you want to see more demonstration, please stop by. We have a table outside this building in the exhibit area. Now, what are the key features of NetEcho? One important feature, as you have heard, is how do you get highlights or important information on a page? Because there are so much information on a page, including ads. Finding the right information is not easy. What we do is we use same algorithm like human eyes and brain use. For example, when you look at a screen, a sighted person look at a screen, our eyes get attracted with features like font size, boldness, color, density, and also meaning of the word. We use similar algorithm to calculate that using the information on the page itself, and then some artificial intelligence rules to use them to calculate the highlights. And in most cases, they are good highlights. And if you don't get your desired highlight in the first three sets, you can always say next one, next one. Or you can find it on that page. We have on-page find command. Then when it goes to the desired page, we have the intelligence to get only the relevant story like our eyes and brain work. So that's what we have really done, contributed to the industry, making today's internet usable by anyone using a telephone and talking and listening. So value proposition to the industry, it's not only for blind, visually impaired, elderly people. It's also good for many people who do not have a computer. And also, more importantly, it is important for bottom of the pyramid. You know, there are over 6 billion people in this world. Only 1 billion people have the access somehow to the internet. The rest, 5 billion, do not. And a lot of them cannot easily get a computer or learn how to use a computer. So this is a nice way to get to the internet to many more people in the world. It is good for many service providers so that they can provide additional service. It is also good for business and government. Many government, information needs to be accessible, as you have heard in the previous talk. And today, if you call a bank or a government institution, you have to answer 5-6 questions, and then you get some results. These are called IVR, or Interactive Voice Response System. These are standalone. They are not connected to the internet. What we are doing, we are bringing them to the internet, because anything on the internet you would be able to access either through a computer or through a telephone. The last but not least contribution is accessibility. As of today, accessibility has been talked about from the angle that it is accessible in a computer or some devices in visual format. Well, think about it now. If we add same content over the phone, we really increase the accessibility significantly, because a lot more people have phones than computers. There are about 400 million connected computers as opposed to 2.2 billion phones. So, computer represents only 14% of the total phone population. All right, now what are the key features of NetEcho? As you have seen, surfing, you can go to any website on the World Wide Web. You can bookmark your websites and so forth. You can do your email using most of the email systems, Yahoo, Hotmail, POP3, which includes, most of the common ISPs like Artlink, NetZero, SBC, and so forth. You can search with any search engine, including Google, Yahoo, MSN. You can do streaming audio. Somebody asked a question about putting books on streaming audio, but if those books are streaming audio, that's great. If they're in text, you can listen to it now with our service also. And then shopping, directory assistance. Directory assistance these days, you have to spend about $2 or so per call. Here it's included in the service. You can also listen to news, weather, horoscopes, and many other features. Now, we have made sure that user interface is very good. You do not have time to go through many steps to get to content. So we have made sure, as you have seen in the demo, you just surf the net, website name, then you hear the content, and you select your favorite content and listen to it. Very few steps. And also the words are chosen so that anybody with any accent almost can be recognized. You know, my accent is not great and she understands me well. So that's a good litmus test to begin with. You can also barge in anytime, but please remember when you barge in, it's like human being. If both of us talk at the same level, none of us would understand each other if we barge in. So there has to be a little pause somewhere. If voice is not good because you got a cold or something, for every command, there is a keypad entry command. How users are using it today? It's mainly for information retrieval. Many people feel very lonely, also very left out from the society because they hear about www on radio, television, newspaper, but they don't really know what it is or they have no way to get to it. So with this service, they basically use it for information retrieval. And what they do mainly is listen to email, surfing, searching, streaming audio, followed by Bible, horoscope, weather, stock quotes, and so forth. Many elderly people have grandkids or grandchildren. They don't talk. They normally send emails. And that's one of the reasons they need to respond to those emails and get this service. How quickly users can learn. As I said, we have made sure that it's easy to learn. It doesn't take several weeks or several months like you have to spend in a computer in learning how to use the computer. So usually it takes few hours to 2 days. Some people might take a little longer, but we have all the information online. If you just say easy guide, then she will tell you how to use it. So we have made sure that learning is easy. Now, finally, what's coming next? That is very important because it's a live technology with long span of life, and we need to do a lot more works to bring a lot more things to you. For example, right now we do basic form filling, but we would like to do generic form filling so that you can do all kinds of transactions, you know, like banking transactions or buying books or using eBay and stuff like that. Then a harder problem, question and answer. Today you have to spell a search word and you get the results. But in future, our goal is like a Star Trek. You say something naturally using your natural language and you get the answer. You cannot do that today with any search engine. These are all parsers, meaning that they just match the word and give you results. No intelligence there. So that is another important thing that will be coming. Also, we are going to provide voice computer so that you can store your files. Everyone will have a virtual computer over the telephone. So you can send your resume to somebody with NetEcho, future version. You can edit your files and store them and so forth. Also, today with NetEcho, you can talk to the internet, as you have heard. But while you are on the internet, we will give you the option to, would you like to call anyone? And if you say yes, then we will ask you which voice over IP engine, Skype or Vonage or something similar. You say Skype, then we will connect you through Skype to anybody in the world. But the key point here is that you are using a regular phone or a cell phone without buying a special broadband phone or a broadband connection. Through NetEcho, you will be able to talk to anybody in the world. So you can either talk to anybody in the world or you can talk to the internet. And finally, when you heard in the demo, we go to a website and you select your content. We give only the relevant content. Now, a relevant content usually is a column of text. And a column of text can be displayed easily on a cell phone screen who can view easily, which is not possible today because they try to rewrite and create a lot more small pages. That is not needed. That's why it is very difficult to see anything today. What we are going to do is render or convert, take the right content instead of rewrite everything and display it automatically on the screen. We call it microbrowser, good for many sighted people in future, but also good for non-sighted people, because those cell phones which can read text will be able to text or read those to you, and you will be able to access any website. With that, I would like to stop and open for questions. I think I finished it before 15 minutes, so probably I have about 5 minutes for Q&A. Jeff will decide.
Yes, well, we'll open it for one question. This is an extraordinarily interesting presentation, and we certainly encourage people to go to the Internet Speech Booth and check them out. But we will take a question. If we have any. Okay, why don't you stand up and we'll have somebody get a mic.
Okay, MDAD, this is Jane.
Hi.
We've never met, and I use this service exclusively, and I love it. It's inexpensive, and my daughter gets excited about it because even when she's in Mexico, you have a choice. If you want to use your own voice, you can, and she's all excited, and she said, Mom, it's you. You know, it comes through in your own voice. But I know there are many things that I don't do with it that I could do with it, but the main thing for me is being able to send email and receive email, and it comes as an attachment, by the way. But it's just a marvelous thing that's opened a brand new world to me. It's inexpensive, and I encourage all of you to give it a try. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much, Jane. Glad to hear that, and glad to know that it is useful to you.
Thank you, Jane.
Nice
since that wasn't a question, we'll now give the question.
Mr. President, Connie Gill, when you have email, can you subscribe to different lists, or can you set up a phone book, things like that?
Yes, we support Yahoo, Hotmail, and POP3. So if you do not have any email, we will give you one from Internet Speech. It will be something at internetspeech.com. But if you have any POP3 like Earthling or NetZero or Bell South or Yahoo or Hotmail, we support all of them. And you can have 100 email addresses in your address book. So yes, you can personalize and change. You can, over the phone, you can change them or delete them and so forth.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was a very interesting presentation. Let's hear it for Mr. Khan. Okay. You know, it's over the last few years, I think that there has been no topic which has created greater interest at our conventions than medical research. And we have another such topic this year. Oh, I have an announcement. That's right. I have an announcement to make before we introduce that topic. Is Dave Phillips in the room? Dave is a contest winner, but he's not here. From the Retina Institute at Mercy General, which is in Sacramento. They're an exhibitor here. So whatever Dave won, well... Ooh, you want a coffee basket. Okay. Okay. Anyway, as I was saying, there's no greater interest in any topic at these conventions than that of medical research. And we have another excellent topic today. We have with us today, from the University of California at Davis, a gentleman who works in the prevention and treatment of eye diseases, Dr. John L. Keltner, Professor and Chair Emeritus of the Director of Research and Faculty Development of the Department of Ophthalmology and Vision Science, Neurology, and Neurological Surgery. And without any further ado, I would like to introduce to you Dr. John Keltner.
President Tom, thank you so much, and thank you for inviting me to speak to you this afternoon. It's really a privilege. Our life in the area of ophthalmology research is devoted to preventing diseases that has taken sight from many of you. And we not only are in the prevention, but obviously the treatment. We feel vision, even when vision is, and we have to teach our residents this, when there's only a little vision left, it's very important. Over the last 40 years, I've been in ophthalmology and ophthalmologic research. I've learned that from patients like yourselves. the very important aspect of we preserve vision at all costs. And that's why we need to know what is the cause of various diseases. And there's obviously amongst many of you a variety of causes which have caused blindness. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing in the Department of Ophthalmology currently in our research areas. Our department first is a department, an academic department, which has four missions, which include obviously patient care is a large part of our mission, taking care of patients with visual problems, education of both residents, medical students, and fellows who are training in various areas of ophthalmology and ophthalmology research and patient care, and then research into a variety of causes of visual loss, which I'll talk about in particular, and then also public service in a variety of ways, and this would obviously be one of them. Our department started over 40 years ago. I was the second chair, and at that time there were only two of us. Our department now has 15 full-time faculty, four at our VA hospital. We have six PhDs involved in research. We have five optometrists, and our staff now is 132 academic staff and faculty. So we've grown quite a bit over the last 35 to 40 years. Our research has really grown along the same lines, and currently we have 66 different research projects in our department. We have almost $14 million now in grants supported by various agencies, including the National Eye Institute. So research is really at the core of our ophthalmology research mission. So what I'd like to do is go through some of the various areas that we're working in specifically, and some of the areas may be areas that if you've had visual problems with and others may not. We won't obviously touch on everything. First, glaucoma is a potential blinding eye disease, which many of you I know may be familiar with. We have some interesting things going on in glaucoma, and some of these are at the national level, some are involved in our own department. First, in the area of protection of the optic nerve. The optic nerve, when the eye pressure, high pressure goes up in the eye, it actually causes loss of vision by damaging the nerves in the eye due to this high pressure. And one of the areas that's been looked into is ways to protect that optic nerve when high pressure goes up. Obviously, we want to lower the pressure with medicines, which we do all the time. But there's a whole field of research, both in the area of stroke and as well as optic nerve protection, called neuroprotection. And there's a drug called memantine, which has now been involved in a worldwide trial to look and see if when patients are on memantine, will this help protect the optic nerve from the ravages of high pressure and from loss. Memantine actually is also being used in the area of Alzheimer's disease. So it's another area of protection of the nervous system. And I should say that glaucoma is the optic nerve when it's damaged. It's called a nerve, but it's really not a nerve. This is the major cable that comes from the brain to the eye, which allows the image to be transmitted from the retina into the brain to be seen. So it's really a tract of the brain, not really a nerve. Well, other things that we have learned recently in glaucoma, we've learned that treatment, obviously, of lowering pressure does protect visual loss. Now, that sounds so fundamental. I think anybody who's had glaucoma and had to take drops says, well, we've known that for many, many years. Well, it's interesting that we really haven't known it as well as you'd think we may have known it. And we've had a large trial called the OATS trial, the Ocular Hypertension Treatment Trial, which our department's been very involved in for the last almost 10 years, which has clearly shown that clearly lowering pressure in the eye for patients who have glaucoma will preserve vision. And we do that obviously with medicines. It's now also being done with a variety of different surgical procedures, and some new valves have been developed. As a matter of fact, we're working with our bioengineering department at UC Davis and making very micro valves and microchips, which will not only allow us to lower pressure in the eye through filtering, but also to monitor the pressure in the eye. In addition, in looking at the field of glaucoma, we know that medicine now lowers the pressure in the eye, but one of the problems when you treat patients who have glaucoma is how well do they take their medicine. And this is not just a problem of patients with glaucoma. This is a problem in all of medicine. a doctor prescribes medicine for a patient, and how well is that patient compliant with taking the medicine? You'd say, well, everybody knows to take their medicine. Well, there's lots of reasons why patients don't take their medicine. They may forget. They ran out of their medicine. A whole variety of issues. And we've been actually looking at the impact of why patients don't take their medicine and what that does in terms of their glaucoma. That's been one of the areas of study. We have also, we're the visual field reading center for the glaucoma trial, which is, as I said, the largest trial in glaucoma going on in the United States today. And we've been doing this for 10 years, looking at the different kinds of field loss that we see in glaucoma and looking in how the pressure and treatment interact together. In addition, we've been the visual field reading center for optic neuritis. And to change gears just a little bit, those of you who have MS or know of MS know that visual loss has often been associated with patients who have MS in the form of optic neuritis, or again, damaging the optic nerve just like it's damaged in glaucoma. And what we've learned in the treatment of the optic neuritis treatment trial was that IV steroids seem to help patients who had optic neuritis to get better quicker, although it didn't change the final outcome. And the exciting thing for me, I'm a neuro-ophthalmologist, is that the treatment of MS has really exploded in the last 10 years. There are many, many drugs. We cannot cure MS, but we've made huge strides forward in the delay and progression of MS symptoms. And obviously vision is a very important part of this treatment that's going on now in the treatment of MS. And this is why I'm so excited about the different drugs that have become available. When I first started in neurology and medicine and ophthalmology going back 35, 40 years ago, we virtually had no drugs that treated MS. We had cortisone and that was it. There are now a whole variety of drugs that can modify the immune response in MS, helping preserve vision, but also helping to prevent the ravages of progressive MS as it goes forward. So it's no longer, used to be when someone was given a diagnosis of MS, you pretty well could not do much about it. That's no longer true. Now we encourage our patients, obviously, to be treated by qualified neurologists who can deal with some of the new drugs that have been developed. So that's a couple of the things going on in the treatment of both glaucoma and the treatment of MS and optic neuritis. I'm going to turn to the front part of the eye, because many times we lose vision because of corneal problems. And the cornea, as you know, is the sort of called a watch glass or the cover of the eye. And there's many, many reasons why we can lose vision by the cornea becoming cloudy. There are corneal dystrophies, there's corneal injury, there's corneal infections. And I'm happy to say that we have four cornea specialists working in the area of corneal surgery. You all know about corneal transplantation, which works in certain instances of visual loss. But we have been in our department and across the country working on artificial corneas. And this is done in two ways. One, there is a keratoprosthesis, which is actually a plastic cornea, if you will, that is put in. This is in people where a corneal transplant won't work. And Dr. Manis, who's chairman of our department now and a corneal surgeon, did a rather miraculous corneal surgery on a patient here just a few years ago, which actually got a fair amount of news coverage, with a keratoprosthesis, where a patient who had actually not seen his grandchildren and had this keratoprosthesis put in because he had a completely opaque cornea, which corneal transplants would not work. This keratoprosthesis was put in, and actually for the first time he actually was able to see his grandchildren. Now obviously this is a unique case and doesn't work in many cases, but certainly for patients who are blind with terrible corneal opacities, this is an option. We actually have Dr. Schwab, who is learning to grow artificial corneas, and he's doing this in the lab. He's growing this. These are made of silk grown in the lab in tissue culture, and he spent a year in Australia learning how to grow these corneal cells in the laboratory, and again to help patients who have not been able to get corneas, cornea transplants would work for them. The new exciting area in Cornell research also transcends into stem cell research. And you're fortunate to be living in the state of California, which has actually, because of our governor and the legislature who have passed a bill to support stem cell research in all areas of medicine, not only in the eye, but in spinal cord, brain, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. And as you know, $3 billion has been devoted for this, and this actually is just getting underway. The money, of course, always gets tied up legally for a while by those who didn't want to see stem cell research go forward. But I think most of these burdens have gotten lifted, and actually now we have two stem cell research programs going on in cornea to grow new surfaces. Again, people who could not maintain their corneal surface, both Dr. Schwab and Dr. Rosenblatt have been working on stem cell research in the cornea, which I think there's great hope for those who have lost vision and where transplants won't work and keratoprosthesis won't work, that stem cell research has some real hope and has already made some real progress in this area of not only preventing blinding eye disease, but to cure or treat people who cannot see because of this. We have also a lot of refractive surgery going on in our department. These are people who have been able to remove their glasses. And we're doing a lot of work in the area of ocular implants. Since I've been in ophthalmology, and I remember as a resident doing cataract surgery, when we had to make large incisions in the cornea or in the sclera, put in these large sutures, to tell you that to just in my lifetime to see the revolution that has happened in cataract surgery is really remarkable. My own wife had to have cataract surgery here about a year ago, and to see how her surgery went and what I did when I was a resident going back to the early 70s is truly remarkable. We've gone from having 6 to 8, 10 sutures having to be put into the cornea or after the cataract was taken out, to now having it done through a 2.5 millimeter incision in the clear cornea, and either there's no sutures that go in or one suture goes in with foldable lenses or very small lenses that go in. And this has really truly revolutionized the field of cataract surgery, that people are able to have that done. Now, let's move into the back part of the eye, and specifically into the area of retina. And this is probably where some of the greatest advances have been made in the last 5 and 10 years in the area of macular degeneration. We see now into the area of retinal generations, AMD, age-related macular degenerations, and I'll talk a little bit about those. And it's really come in two ways. One, in the ability to measure when retinas are not doing well. This is in these imaging techniques. We have a man in our department by the name of Jack Warner. He's a PhD. We recruited him about 5, 6 years ago. And he's able to image the retina, and he has a very, very elegant device. It's actually a takeoff on the Hubble telescope. And I call it the Hubble telescope because this particular device is now so advanced, we can actually take pictures of patients in the living eye when we can actually see individual rods and cones. And this is very remarkable. 5 years ago, we couldn't do that. And we actually, I call it the Hubble telescope of the eye because Dr. Warner is able in his laboratory now with patients. We can take pictures of the retina. We can look at the retina and make the diagnosis and see things that we couldn't see before. Can actually look now at disease states where only could do this in laboratory animals. So the tools to look at disease states and to look at in advanced states have really revolutionized our ability to deal with retinal disease. Now, how's that changed what's going on? Well, there are a variety of clinical trials. I told you we're involved in 66 different research projects in our department right now. But what's probably most exciting is in the field of age-related macular degeneration. And there may be many of you who have lost your vision or lost your central sight because of age-related macular degeneration. And I can tell you that the future is bright, because we've been able, through the first trial that came out with the ARID study, and there are really two types of macular degeneration. There's the wet type and the dry type. Now, unfortunately, the majority of people lose their sight is with the dry type. And this has been the tougher one to deal with on a research basis. But first, let me deal with the wet type. The wet type, which happens with people who have the dry type, often will go on and develop abnormal blood vessels. These blood vessels developed in the macula. They cause leakage. They cause leakage of not only proteins and exudates, and this can be devastating to vision. We have now several studies, and in just in the last 5 to 10 years, and really in the last 2 years, new medicines have been released which deals with the new blood vessels to stamp out these blood vessels, and we've seen some very dramatic reversals and halting of progressive visual loss in the wet type of macular degeneration, but with these anti-VEGF. These are growth factors which prevent blood vessels from growing and causing loss in the wet type of macular degeneration. One of the names of these drugs you may have heard of is called Lucentis, just released last June from Genentech. Another one, Avastin, also another Genentech drug. And these, in my lifetime, I've seen, this has been really quite remarkable, and being able now to measure the changes in the retina with our new imaging that I told you about with Dr. Warner has helped us dramatically to improve our monitoring of patients who are losing vision through macular degeneration, and then the ability to treat them, particularly with the wet type, with both Lucentis, with Macugen, with Avastin. These are drugs that halt the progressive loss of vision through these inhibition of this destructive destructive VEGF factors. As a matter of fact, it's interesting, when we look at drugs that we had discarded in the past, all of you will remember years ago when there was a drug that was causing congenital malformations women who are taking them. And this was a drug that turns out is a VEGF inhibitor, and this got taken off the market years ago because it was causing loss of vision in patients who had were taking it for birth control and taking it for other measures. Well, it turns out it's a wonderful drug to be used in the vitreous to prevent macular degeneration. So these anti-VEGF and growth factor drugs have revolutionized the treatment of macular degeneration. We're also looking at other risk factors for macular degeneration. I think most of you may be aware now that smoking is bad for you. Smoking is bad for you. I tell my residents and medical students, if you thought smoking was bad because of lung cancer, stroke, and heart attacks, there are five things in the eye that smoking does that are bad. The first is it causes and aids in macular degeneration. The second is cataracts. The third is stroke in the eye. The fourth is it can cause central retinal artery occlusion. And the fifth is it will make patients who have thyroid eye disease have worse thyroid eye disease. So we try to get patients at all costs who have any kind of macular problems off of smoking. Now, the dry type of macular degeneration, which many of you may have, has been a much harder area to treat. But we had a breakthrough with the ARIDS trial, which came out from the NIH several years ago, which showed in those patients who had moderate or advanced macular degeneration that a combination of ARIDS vitamin, which consists of antioxidants, these were vitamin C, vitamin E, copper, zinc, and lutein, actually slowed the progress of dry macular degeneration. Now, this was really an amazing accomplishment because I don't think anybody thought that this would work, but it actually did. It did not help people who were normal and had very early macular degeneration, and it wasn't recommended for patients who are normal otherwise. Because of this trial, though, it was recognized that were certain things that could be looked at differently in a second trial, which is actually just getting underway, called ARIDS 2, which is multivitamins with lutein and omega-3 fatty acids. Omega-3s, you know, are in fish, and we've all been recommended to eat more fish, but obviously limited fish. Now, what's important in this is patients should not go out and take mega vitamins because it turns out too much of a good thing can be bad for you. For example, in this trial on ARIDS 1, there was a carotene. Carrots is in carrots, right? Carotene for carrots. turns out people who are smokers and were in this trial and were on this drug with carotene had an increased risk for lung cancer. So like most things, and the patients, the doctors now who are putting patients on the ARDS vitamins are really warning them, take it what's prescribed, what we know about it, don't take excessive amounts. And we've known this about vitamins for a long time. I mean, there are certain vitamins, you can take too much of vitamin A, you can take too much of vitamin C and get kidney stones. So we need to stick with what we know, and then what we don't know, stay away from. But it's been quite exciting that now ARDS 2 is going on to advance macular degeneration to see if the addition of omega-3s, lutein, and others will actually help. And this, as I say, just getting started, and we don't have the results of this for quite a while. Now, also in the areas of retinitis pigmentosa, and there may be some of you have that, there are things that are actually being done. There's a treatment trial which has gotten launched by Neurotech, and this is to do retinal rescue. Actually, Dr. Larry Yemelin, some of you may know Larry. Larry is actually completely blind. He's been in my department now almost 20 years. I actually recruited him. He went blind completely from diabetic and diabetic retinopathy. And Larry's a walking miracle. He was one of our best researchers, and actually has been doing research to treat his own disease, which was diabetes, which he went blind from many, many years ago. And Larry discovered a certain type of RPE cell which puts out a certain type of growth factor. And this growth factor actually helped to stimulate retinal pigment epithelial cells and helped to stimulate photoreceptors. And in the first trial done at the NIH, they actually found in patients with end-stage RP had some actually improvement in their vision. And Neurotech is actually, not great amounts, this is not a cure, but Neurotech is now, they took these RPE cells and have developed a very small implant device that they are now going to be recruiting for, and actually David Thielander at our department is going to be starting recruitment for patients who have advanced retinitis pigmentosa to do this implant and to measure if, one, you can rescue rescue not only RPE but also rescue photoreceptors that may be able to restore some vision or at least save the vision that patients with advanced retinitis pigmentosa have. And this is really, to me, a revolutionary breakthrough in the treatment of retinitis pigmentosa, because obviously if this works for this group of patients, it will move back into patients who have less advanced retinitis pigmentosa to save them before they get into the more advanced stages. There's also gene work going on in this area. You may have heard of a disease called Usher syndrome. And there was a famous dog who the researchers, University of Pennsylvania, actually did through viral vector work, were able to inject viral vectors with certain genes into the dogs who had Usher syndrome, and in one eye did it, in the other eye didn't. These were dogs who were going to go on to get blind. In the eye that the dogs got the vector injected, they actually prevented these eyes from going to get Usher syndrome. So gene therapy is clearly, we're not there yet in many areas, although now national trial is starting with Usher syndrome to look at it in infants or children, young people who are born with it, that will potentially be able to be treated with this viral vector syndrome. And I think eventually, clearly, this may also be the case for retinitis pigmentosa. There are many, many, many causes of retinitis pigmentosa from a gene standpoint, but we really haven't transmitted that threshold to get over into being able to do this. But clearly this viral vector work now with Usher syndrome that's going on at the national level is going to be a major advance, I think, and will hopefully in the future be able to take patients who know they're predestined to lose vision with retinitis pigmentosa and with Usher syndrome and hopefully prevent this or keep it at a very early stage. Well, let's now move into the field of diabetic retinopathy. Those of you who have lost your vision, as Dr. Yemelin did, Dr. Yemelin spent his entire life now on the treatment of diabetic eye disease, but since he's completely blind with diabetic eye disease, and as I say, he was the one who really developed this RPE cell that is now being used in the RP retinitis pigmentosa trials. There's also, we're looking at injecting into the vitreous in patients with diabetic macular edema with certain drugs that can then prevent the macular edema, help to resorb it, also potentially to restore some of the vision lost with macular edema. And clearly, the next area that I'll touch on is stem cell research in the retina itself. And we have two retinal researchers, both involved now in stem cell research. Dr. T. Lander is involved in stem cell research with murine. That's using this in mice to look at a model of stem cell taking embryonic stem cells. And as you know, unfortunately, embryonic stem cells has not been allowed to be done at the national level. As a matter of fact, it will be done probably in California, but even that got stopped in the legal battle that came once the whole thing on the stem cell, $3 billion got put through in that that bill. Unfortunately, got tied up in the courts, but I do think that embryonic stem cells will be in some form or other be allowed to use, and they may be first in California. At the federal level, it's still been a major problem for us, but I think clearly Dr. T. Lander is now looking at embryonic stem cells in a mice model of macular and retinal degeneration. And we have Dr. Susanna Park, who's looking at a bone marrow stem cell model. Stem cells are now being done for patients who have had heart attacks. They're drawing off their own stem cells and are regrowing them, and then are looking to inject these back into the heart muscle to make the heart muscle repair itself. Well, Dr. Susanna Park is now putting together a project. She's looking at taking patients' own stem cells out of their bone marrow, growing their stem cells into culture, and then re-injecting these back in people who have lost their retinal visual loss from vein occlusions. And clearly, we're now looking at stem cells. How can they help us in advanced forms of retinal degeneration, both blood vessel retinal degeneration, diabetes, vein occlusions, age-related macular degeneration, as well as retinal hyspigmatosis? Well, the last area that I'd sort of touch on would be that of autoimmune activity in the eye. There's a variety of autoimmune diseases, from lupus to rheumatoid arthritis, which actually these are, and even in cancers. And Dr. Thirkel and I have been working with cancer-associated retinopathy for many years. Certain cancers, lung cell cancers, will actually make antibodies against the cancer, which then attack the retina and attack the optic nerve. And we've now isolated several of these antibodies. And this research is translated back into macular degeneration research, because it looks like when you lose vision from macular degeneration, as you break up the photoreceptors, your body makes antibodies against these, which then attack further in your retina. So we're now looking with Dr. T. Lander again how to interrupt these immune products that are attacking the retina in age-related macular degeneration. And finally, in terms of optic nerve, although we're not the ones that are specifically involved in optic nerve regeneration, it's clearly something I'm very interested in, because I deal, again, in neuro-ophthalmology. People have lost their vision with strokes of the nerve, optic neuritis of the nerve, and various other optic neuropathies. And there's a variety of research going on in looking at optic nerve regeneration and protection, and also on stimulation of optic nerve, which we hope potentially may be able to regenerate optic nerve. Not here yet. Clearly in our lifetime, I think we'll see advances. If you'd have told me what we're doing now, both in MS and in macular degeneration and retinal degeneration 30 years ago, I would have said I would not have believed that in my lifetime this would have occurred. But it's clear to me that particularly you're fortunate to be living in California, where $3 billion has been set aside for stem cell research. And I think stem cell research in the eye, not only anteriorly in the eye for cornea, but also posteriorly in the retina, the macula, retinal degeneration, and potentially also in optic nerve growth. In the area of pediatric ophthalmology, although I don't see many children in the audience, to let you know, we have a full research program going on in that. Lazy eye or amblyopia, Dr. Mary O'Hara is part of our pediatric eye study group, which is a national study group, looking at the best ways to treat infants and children who have lazy eye and amblyopia, and many things we learned about in terms of patching. Now we can patch children not only with patches, but we can patch them by just dilating the good eye to make the bad eye work. So lots of things going on that are very exciting in that area. Just to also let you know that we have a whole visual science research group. We have now almost 70 members of the visual science research group in Davis, and this is a bridge between the clinicians in Sacramento and UC Davis, as well as the basic scientists in Davis. We have an entire research team down in Davis. We call the Visual Science Research Group. Right now, they cross 13 departments, going from the cortex to the cornea, we call it, and that's where our visual science research really extends. We're doing research into blinding eye diseases, literally from the cornea all the way into the cortex, and the cortex meaning from neurodegenerations, stroke, and the whole thing. And finally, I finish up with we have the two authors of the famous book now called The Visual Neurosciences, which is really the definitive textbook of the visual neuroscience, co-authored by Jack Werner, who's the person I talked about doing all the imaging study, and Leo Chalupa, who's doing very basic research into the embryonic way our eye gets started when it's first developed into later in life. So I would be happy to talk and answer any questions, but I hope that I brought a little good news for you, that there is lots of fantastic research in ophthalmology and vision science going on at the present time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have a time just for a couple of questions. What an incredible amount of information.
Too much.
Volunteer, come and get you and bring you up front. We have two people at the mic.
Okay, that's about all we'll have time for.
Dirk Neihardt again from Berkeley Chapter. Does that make any difference for pressure on the eye? Should I eat more brown rice and yogurt, or have more wild turkey?
You know, excellent question. Let me answer that question first. You know, the interesting in the ARID study, we couldn't prove because there's no study's been designed to look at what does a healthy lifestyle do. But there's no question that clearly age-related macular degeneration is going to benefit from the same things that benefit good healthy living, from cerebral vascular disease to heart disease to the rest. So I encourage all my patients to live as healthy a lifestyle as you can. I mean, it just makes sense. What you're putting in your mouth is the engine that drives the machine, and if you're eating a lot of bad stuff, you know, I mean, it either is going to rot your brain cells or rot your eye cells, but it can't be good for it, right?
Doctor, what is being done with retinal detachments? Any new research on that?
Yeah, always, yes. As a matter of fact, this morning we had Alan Krieger, Buzz Krieger we call him, who's one of the retina specialists from UCLA at our grand rounds. And the field of retinal attachment has revolutionized dramatically since when I was a resident 35 years ago. How to get the least amount of trauma to stick the retina back on. When a retina comes on, think of what a retinal attachment is. It's first the film of the eye. The eye is just a camera. That's all it is. It's a camera. Focuses, that's what the purpose of your cornea and your lens is, to focus on the film in the camera, which is the retina, which then attaches to the optic nerve, which goes back to your brain, and we see with our brain. So when that film comes off, the question is how to get it to stick back on into the eye. And that's done by laser, which is like welding it back to the eye. It's done by putting air in the eye to stick it back on, and then laser, and then put some cryo or freeze it, which is like glue trying to get it to stick back on. So all of the efforts have been driving at how to do the least amount of trauma to the eye to get that retina to stick back on in the simplest and most least traumatic way. So there's been dramatic changes in the years that I've watched it go on and continuing ongoing areas in the retina. The last area of what happens in the retina is when it gets off, and if it gets, there's a lot of fibrosis that occurs, vitrectomy going in to remove that scar tissue, that's been revolutionized. And when I started as a resident, almost in 1970, vitrectomy wasn't even done. We didn't know what vitrectomy was. So just in my lifetime, these things, so there's research in each one of these areas. So for those people who have retinal attachments, if it's been off a long time, that's not good. But if it's clearly a recent retinal attachment, the way to get that back on is becoming much easier, and the success rate, again, is much better.
I have a few comments to make before I ask a few questions.
Okay, no, actually, we're going to have to.
Oh, okay.
It's going to have to be
well,
really quick.
I have to say you guys are very good because I'm a patient of your department. But anyway, what I want to know is one of our friends has macular degeneration. I don't know which kind it is. She lives here in Sacramento also. Does she need to be referred by her ophthalmologist to you?
You know, I would have her ophthalmologist, if she feels comfortable that she understands all she needs to find. If not, have her referred to a retina specialist, either one in the community or at our medical center. I like people to make sure they understand where they are. Most comprehensive ophthalmologists that are well educated now, I mean, this the Arids formula that came out is well known. It's been out for a number of years. So hopefully if she's got a good comprehensive ophthalmologist, she's been sort of educated as to the things to look for and that she's on the right type of vitamins if she's a candidate. Remember, if she does not have moderate or advanced AMD, she shouldn't be on the vitamins. There's no evidence that it helps her. And remember, too much of a good thing can be too much also. So I would just make sure that she feels comfortable that she's gotten a good explanation of what's going on.
Okay, and I have another quick question.
No, we're going to have to limit you to one because there are other people.
Okay.
Sorry, Karen.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. It was a privilege, and we hope we gave you a little information.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to go to our last speaker now. Well, as far as someone has a question about getting a copy, we will certainly be archiving this on the web. There will be convention tapes made available. So there are various ways, and we don't charge for those. So you will be able to obtain a copy of this presentation should you want one. Okay. I think Kathy Skyers would probably agree with me that there are no more disturbing calls that we get in CCB, and we get many, than some of the ones dealing with people who are either homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. And in fact, today I commend the Crisis Committee for intervening in a case where someone, as topical as this is, someone would have lost their Section 8 voucher in a few days, and this organization intervened in a way that will hopefully prevent that from happening. We have with us, Lee Morton and her committee do an outstanding job. Section 8 is just an incredibly important program to so many low-income people. And we have with us today Fred Nyssen, staff attorney from the Oakland Office of Protection and Advocacy, who will be assisted by a staff attorney from the Sacramento office, Stuart Seymour, to tell us about what we can do with respect to Section 8. And without taking any more of their time, I want to bring Fred Nyssen and Stuart Seymour on. Gentlemen? Yes.
Before they begin, I've been quiet all day. Would you ask the people in this room to join me? It's rude to talk about other people's cars.
I second that one.
Yes.
What did she want?
Oh, I'm sorry, Kathy, I couldn't hear you. Yes, people, do not talk. Be polite to our listeners. Thank you, Kathy. Okay, Fred and Stuart?
Baby, before I begin, I realize that we only have 3 minutes. So, I realize we only have 3 minutes. So, there are copies of a memo in large print. and sister in the back. If it's not enough, you can call our office and I'll be happy to send this.
Before we leave today, I'll leave cards with Braille contact information too. About the presentation. Before we leave today, I will leave cards with our Braille contact information if people have questions about the presentation or Section 8 and for housing in general.
We were asked to talk about the reason that the AIDS crisis and the begin with. Let me give you a little background. How did the Department of Housing and Development basically tell the housing authorities how much of a rent they can pay?
People get that HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, tells the housing authorities what people can pay in terms of the fair market, in terms of the payments, the fair market rent, and the housing authority then has a choice of setting its payment standard within 90 to 110% of that fair market rent. But the decision on the fair market rent is set up by HUD. And that's a national decision. So this is actually one situation where the local housing authorities may not be to blame, although a little advocacy would be needed on their part.
So when person is about the generally pay 30% of their adjusted income for rent and utilities.
So if your adjusted income was $1,000 and you're paying 30% of that adjusted income, generally you'd be paying $300, and there is a utility allowance, which we won't get into, but it's generally 30% to start out with in Section 8, and as Fred will describe, there may be now and in the near future changes to that.
If the rent that you are the landlord is requesting is above this payment standard, you can pay the additional amount. If you are moving into a place, you can only have the total portion of the rent be 40% of the existing income.
So when you're moving into a place, the housing authority and HUD allow you to pay if there's a difference between what the landlord is charging and what the payment standard is, you can pay that difference up to a point that reaches 40% of your income. So you can actually move from 30 to 40% if the landlord is charging something that is over the payment standard. If, for example, if the rent is $1,100 and the payments standard only allows rent of $1,000, and your income is $1,000, 30% of your income would be $300, but because there's a $100 difference between the payment standard and the rent you're paying, you'd pay an extra $100 to bring it to 40% of your income. You'd end up paying $400.
But if the payment standard, if you have been living in the unit for more than a year and the rent goes up and all the payment standard goes down, you could pay the difference, even if it's above 40%.
So what Fred's saying, this is actually something we're seeing now, is HUD is actually giving the housing authorities less in terms of what they can do with fair market rent. So the payment standards are actually going down. And if you've been in your place for more than a year, this 40% limit actually doesn't apply. And that's something we figured out recently. So in that same example, say the payment standard went down to $900 and you'd been in the apartment for more than a year, you might have to pay an additional $100 to make up the difference, even though that would be taking you over the 40%. That's something that HUD has been working in there, and we've been noticing with our calls.
This has only been happening for the last 6 months, and will probably continue to happen for the next 6 months or a year. It's based on your annual recertification.
So what Fred's saying is that's based on the annual recertification, and what we've seen is that there's often a two-year grace period. I think the HUD announcement came out in 2004.
Yeah.
So now with 2 years passing, people have gotten this kind of two-year grace period with their recertifications, but it's starting to actually come into effect. So you may be seeing folks that have been comfortable in their Section 8 apartments. They've been covered by this grace period, and all of a sudden their portion of the rent may start to increase, and it's a result of HUD changing what the fair market rents are for a variety of communities, especially important in a place like California where market rents themselves are so high.
The people with disabilities, however, there is a way to get around this. If you are in a unit that specifically meets your needs and you cannot find another unit that meets your needs within the amount of rent the housing authority can pay, you can ask for the higher payment standard as a reasonable accommodation.
So what Fred's saying is for people with disabilities, there actually is a potential accommodation when we're dealing with payment standards, and that is if there's a particular unit that meets the needs of an individual with a disability and it has to be very specific to their specific needs and it's got to meet a certain set of criteria. One example might be a ground floor, a person that uses a wheelchair, a ground floor apartment that has specs that their wheelchair can fit in and any assistive technology or equipment that they use could fit in that apartment. What the person with a disability needs to show the housing authority is that specific apartment meets their needs, and in their area there are not others that meet their needs that fall within the payment standard.
Another example might be the person with visual unable to actually go out and look for my Virginia.
So that's actually, those are reasonable accommodation arguments for a person that's in a unit with visual impairments. First, if a person with a visual impairment has set up the apartment to meet their needs and it already exists to meet their needs, that's one argument. The other would be if you, for whatever reason, as a part of your disability's limitations, cannot get out and look for another unit, that's another potential argument for an accommodation. And because this policy is new from HUD and the grace period is just now starting to expire, I would encourage all of you to bring this argument up with the housing authorities and push them on it. And if you need help, to contact Protection and Advocacy, because they may not be aware. And even if it's been used in another housing authority, it may be new to them, and so that's something we need to push throughout the state.
And just to let folks know that the process is different depending on what the rent is. If the rent is up to 110% of fair market rent, and the payment standard is less than that, the average salary must bring it up for person with disability. If it's up to 120% of fair market rent, I'd get them. But I've been a boy, I had to regret how to feel all this in San Francisco. For permission to grant acceptance payment standard. Anything above that has to go to Washington, D.C.
So what Fred is saying is that there are three different stages in terms of level of approval for reasonable accommodations or exception rent as a reasonable accommodation going above the payment standard. Up to 110% of the payment standard is something that local housing authority, like the City of Sacramento Housing Authority or the City of San Francisco Housing Authority, can approve without going to HUD. So if for some reason you're in a city that has a payment standard that's actually below 110% of the fair market, you can push the housing authority to do it itself, and it does not have to seek approval from HUD. If it's between 110% and 120% of the fair market rent, the housing authority has to go to the local HUD office and seek approval. But that's something that we would follow up on. I would advocate with the housing authority to make sure that they do this, and it may also make sense for the advocate or the person with the disability, the tenant, to actually contact the local HUD office to make sure the housing authority is following up. If it's above 120% of the fair market rent for that area, it has to be approved by HUD in Washington, D.C.
And HUD in Washington, D.C. isn't real good about approving acceptance. They haven't approved one since 2005. But in order to request an acceptance, you need to write a letter to the housing authority. It's specifically saying why you need a unit. And what features are in the unit that you need? that if they can, actually go so far that they admit sinners.
Yeah, I think what Fred is saying is it's important to be as specific as possible when you make a written request for an exception rent as a reasonable accommodation to the housing authority and then to HUD. They're very critical when it comes to how thoroughly a person is looked or what the market rents are in the area. So it's very important, if you can, to do a thorough search and present the details of that search to the housing authority. If you can't do the search, I would document specifically why you cannot do the search, and then you may even want to seek assistance of an advocate or somebody in the community to kind of back up your search and present data that there are not units that meet your needs within the payment standard, because the first kind of gut reaction of many housing authorities is to say no until they're presented with overwhelming evidence.
And I recommend that you get a note from a doctor saying what you need in a unit, or if you cannot look for a unit, why you can't look for a unit.
That's very important. To the extent you can get medical documentation to show why you cannot look for a unit or why a specific unit meets your needs, that's going to be more persuasive to the housing authority, and we have seen it's been more persuasive with HUD.
And what I've found out going back to who approved it, but we tried to get approval for somebody near 125% of fair market rent, but we saw 120% since that would be easier to get approved, and the rules did not allow that. Is it the 125%? You have to have the 125%. However, if it's 115% of their market rate, you can have 110%. So, it would never even go up.
That's a good point, that if you've got a rent that's at 115% and you're concerned about going to HUD because you'd have to go over, you have to go to HUD if it goes over 110%, you can ask for the 110%. But that's not the case if the rent is above 120%. Anything above 120% would have to go to HUD in Washington, D.C.
I just wanted to let you know that we did it. I'm going to leave it open for questions, but I would encourage you to take a handout on the way out. Or give it and give us a call if you have any questions by using the 800 number that we'll give you.
I would echo that sentiment that if you have any questions or if you or you know anybody who's going to go through this with the Housing Authority and with HUD, we do have experience working on these issues. In some of the metropolitan areas in California, we've actually had experience getting exceptions to the payment standard approved, and so you can always contact us if you have questions, and in some cases we may be able to assist you in advocacy.
Oh, hold on. Let's wait till questions until the end.
It's time for questions now.
Okay. We're ended. You can get to the mic. Thank you very, very much, both of you. Okay, let's get some questions. As he's getting up there, Ed, don't we have materials...
At the registration table.
It's on the website, too.
I'll just wait a second for him. My question is that in San Luis Obispo County, I don't know whether this can be implemented, but the question I have is that can two people that are on Section 8 pull their resources together to live in a two-bedroom apartment?
I just had a call like this. What would happen is you would one of the prison vouchers and they would take it to prison voucher. Did you get that? Oh. Let me repeat it. You would have one person request it's two-bedroom voucher, but the other person on the voucher.
So you'd have one person request a two-bedroom voucher and put the other person on the voucher. Another thing that we've seen is if one of the potential tenants has a disability, that oftentimes, and this is, it's getting less and less common as HUD gets more stringent and housing authorities have less money to work with, but we have had situations in the past where somebody with a one-bedroom voucher has gotten approval to have a two-bedroom unit based on a disability accommodation.
It would depend on... It would depend on if the person needs a living...
So what I'm understanding that, like if a housemate situation, if that person qualified for Section 8 and I qualify for Section 8, then it is possible that we are able to live in the same house.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, do we have any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay. People can come up at the end and get at the front and get Fred's business cards. And with that, let us thank Fred and Stuart for their outstanding presentation. We are adjourned until this evening.